We're going to start. All right. Well, thank you all for hanging in. It's not as much of a hanging in as it used to be when we went till 4 or 5 in the afternoon on a second day. But so, and if any of you need to run out and catch planes, we will be locking the doors. So leave now or forget it. First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming to the conference, all the panelists, everyone for kind of staying into this early end of the session. And I also want to thank our sponsors, GSK, Astellas, Geron, Fortress, Kinexium, and Torreya. So what is this all about, point, counterpoint? Well, the idea, and I would like this to be a spirited interaction from the audience, please. The idea is to really, in the spirit of all the different themes that we've heard through the day, at yesterday and today, to really kind of talk about these, because many of them are kind of point-counterpoint issues or different philosophies that may be opposing or different ways of viewing, you know, where the future of oncology is going, should be going, how you get to where it should be going. So that's kind of the idea here. We've had a bit of flux on the panel, so thank you for those who are here. Thank you for those who have subbed at last minute. Apologies for those who are not here. If you were expecting to see either Axel Hoos, you have John instead, or Peter Sandor, who, as I said earlier, had to go off to Tokyo to headquarters for meetings. So, all right. So I'm going to start this at a high level, but based on a very definitive recurring theme, whether it was in Dr. Esserman's keynote address, whether it was in Joel's excellent panel, and that is the idea of diagnostics and precision medicine, et cetera. And so before kind of framing some of my issues and questions around that, I'm going to first let each of the panelists at least just briefly self-introduce themselves. And then Brian is going to give a brief slide set overview that I think will play into this kind of first point as well as lay the foundation for some of the other things that we'll be talking about. So, John, we'll start with you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and congratulations for making it through lunch and making it here to the final session. So my name is John Cantello, and I'm heading up business development for the oncology therapy area within GlaxoSmithKline. And I need to confess, unlike basically every other panel member who's been here today as well as yesterday, I'm not a deep expert in oncology. So I'm a business development professional. I've been doing business development for about 18 years now, and I consider myself a generalist in disease areas. So I needed to make that disclaimer. And then as Jeff had just said, I'm sitting in for Axel Hoos, so I apologize for that as well. I'm not Axel. And so I'm already starting off with two strikes, and hopefully that'll be the last two that you hear today. So that's me.
Yeah, my name is Christoph Lengau. I spent about a third of my professional career in academia, another third in big pharma, and the last third in biotech. My last job was at Blueprint Medicines, where I was CSO for the last 6 years, and next week I'm starting a new company.
Wow.
And Brian, though you should need no introduction.
Well, I'm Brian. I'm British by origin, spent 17 years in Canada, about 35 years in the U.S. I keep on getting thrown out of countries all the time. I've run a couple of cancer centers at McGill and at Emory, and now my life is basically devoted to bringing sequencing, targeted therapies, and the new immunotherapies at the earliest possible stage in cancer.
So, Brian, do you want to
control
from up here?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll do it however you want.
There you go.
Perfect.
I will stand aside.
So before anyone falls asleep, this is going to take about 4 minutes. So, I mean, this is basically the human genome. I mean, if you can take any large book, and it basically has 6 billion letters in there and 20,000 chapters. It's extremely simple. So this all basically came out of 2001. So if you look at that, if you take your 20,000 chapters, what was transformative here was oncogenes, which were basically discovered around late 70s, early 80s. Just to age me, and I'm 68, I say it openly, when I did my fellowship at Sloan Kettering, it was not known what caused cancer. So this basically came out, the original HER2 papers in around 1983. Varmus and Bishop won the Nobel Prize in 1989. So we went from an old generation of chemotherapy into targeted therapies. And then the other critical thing is, and this is the old Hanahan and Weinberg, you don't even need to go on to the 2011 one. This is the 2001. But it used to be thought that each of these key properties which drove the cancer all belonged in one cell. And then Nelly Polyak, 3 years ago, showed that basically each property resides in a different cell. So you can have invasion in the blue, angiogenesis in the green, you can have proliferation in the purple, but basically it is a family that supports each other. So if you have one dominant family member, if the father is especially strong, the family is basically dysfunctional. And the more the family cooperates together, the stronger the cancer is. So the simpler cancers that are basically being cured, like those HER2-driven or CML, are the ones where you have a dominant member in the family. When you have significant cooperation across all the clones, those are basically the more difficult cancers to treat. So the other thing is, how long has life been on the planet? 4 billion years. And we have 37 trillion cells in our bodies and about 2 meters of DNA in every cell. So life is incredibly complex. And the people at Harvard, the founder of the Broad, Eric Lander, once described a cancer as essentially evolution within 10 years, the complete history of evolution. So the cancer evolves. So what I do in my practice is I treat the original clones and I try to treat the anticipated, what we call resistant clones. So somebody asked me what this meant this morning, and my analogy was very simple. If you close that door over there with one drug, I'm sorry, just close one door, everyone will run out of this door. And then the red one is the basement door. So you basically need to close the two apparent doors, the yellow, the purple, but also anticipate what the resistant clones will be. And that is our practice. So these are some great slides from Bert Vogelstein. Shows a typical metastatic tumor. You can see, you don't need red arrows on this thing. You can just see the black blobs and the size of those metastases in the liver tumor. And that is the size of an average mouse. And this is the size of a large mouse tumor. And as Bert always turns around and says, I can cure mice very easily because I'm treating that little speck and not multiple of these large masses. So he said the secret is treating early. So what we do is we treat early. This slide is 30 years old. And we hit every clonal population. Whenever I go into Blue Cross Blue Shield, they always say, no, we don't want to hear from you. Hit hard, hit early. That's the message. So the analogy, it's all been out there before. This is tuberculosis from the 1940s, British ward. And you can just see this was triple therapy, all basically delivered very early on. What happened with AIDS? AIDS was triple therapy, all treated early on. So what is going to happen is sequencing at diagnosis will be utterly routine And in fact, not sequencing a diagnosis will be malpractice in 5 years. So if any of you have a tumor, you should sequence a diagnosis. So this is truly a paradigm shift. So just so that the panel knows what I'm going to be saying, I truly believe that cancer is going to be cured in 10 years. And how? So cancer is already moving from a disease of location into a disease of drivers. So basically, if you have three drivers for a particular tumor, you match with three targeted drugs. The FDA has been fantastic, truly remarkable recently, and they've approved a whole host of drugs. We're reaching up to about 100 targeted therapies, and as Jeff, as you and I have discussed, we're probably going to be hitting up to 50 immunotherapies pretty soon. So we're going to have this whole host. So we now have chemotherapies. There are about 60 from 1943 onwards. The first targeted therapy was approved in 1998. We've got about 100 of those. And immunotherapy, the whole field is exploding. And the next one, and you had a session on this, is going to be on the tumor microenvironment. So what we routinely do in our patients is basically a foundation one on the tissue. We also do a blood test to see what is floating in the bloodstream. So we do a foundation act and a foundation one at diagnosis, and then we follow what's circulating in the bloodstream every 3 months. And we modulate therapy based upon what is floating in the bloodstream. And so we run a sequencing service. We match drugs to targets extremely early, and then we basically flex based upon what's floating in the bloodstream. So one very quick example before I close. This is a poor 39-year-old chap. So if all you have to do is look at the letters. Pancreatic cancer, cholangiocarcinoma, this was a fatal cancer. So he was fortunate enough to have Lynch syndrome. So when you have Lynch and you have MLH1, that perfectly matches against the PD-1 drugs. He was lucky enough to have a RET mutation, which matched perfectly to cabozantinib, and we also gave a base chemotherapy, which was cisplatin. This chap was completely filled with tumor in all of his bones and his liver. Within 3 months, so that was the combination, pembro, cabozantinib, and cisplatin. Within 3 months, all of his circulating DNA disappeared. He has been in complete remission ever since. This is the model of the way we should be treating cancer. If any of you or any of your relatives have a tumor and they're not sequencing and they're not sequencing early, change your oncologist. So just to close, these are our current results. We've got 90% of the patients under disease control. We've had 55% have a positive RECIST response. So this is literally transforming the treatment of cancer. One of the major problems of the academic centers is they're giving one drug, choosing a dominant alteration. At this point, we have to choose all the driving alterations right at the beginning and treat incredibly aggressively. So the last two slides, I deleted one. But anyway, in my excitement, I deleted the one. So if I can just go back, what is happening now is Foundation 1 is sequencing at 12,000-fold. I'm sorry, 1,200-fold. Foundation ACT is sequencing at 5,000-fold. GRAIL sequences at 60,000-fold. And the price will come down to $500. So when that happens, every time you go for your annual physical, for $500, and it will probably be less when this is implemented. You will have an annual test sequenced at 60,000-fold, and as soon as you have 300, 400 tumoral cells circulating in your blood, then we can treat with a combination of perhaps chemo, but probably unlikely, targeted therapies, immunotherapies, and tumor microenvironment modulators at that point in time, because it's probably going to be 10 years. But if you think about that, metastatic cancer will disappear. Everything will be monitored on a ctDNA or a CTC, and you will abolish the tumor before it is ever radiologically apparent. The only caveat on this is we have to avoid what happened with mammography. So if you look at what happened in mammography, here you've got 6,000 women over here, 10,000 overall, 3,500 negative. You've got 6,000 over here, of whom 940 will have an unnecessary biopsy. And in doing sequencing every year for 10 years repeatedly, you basically have 10 deaths averted. So the one thing as Grail or Hopkins or whichever platform moves forwards is we have to avoid overdiagnosis. And that's what everyone's working on. I talked with Phil Stevens, who's the chief scientific officer at Grail, about 2 weeks ago. Everyone is trying to avoid the issue of overdiagnosis. But when you have the right balance of sensitivity with selectivity, then metastatic cancer will disappear.
Thank you, Brian. All right, well, that sets up a good vision that we can discuss and should discuss. So, John, Christoph, reactions to the vision that's laid out. Is it a no-brainer and obvious? Is it problematic in some way? That's either obvious or not obvious.
Maybe a reflection first. It's interesting. Just so that everybody knows, I spent 10 years in the Vogelstein lab. And when we discovered, it's not 25 years, that's crazy. 25 years ago, we discovered mismatch repair genes. And nobody gave a shit, really. Because it was so rare. It was 8% of colon cancers. Like, who cares? Like, we want to understand the other 92. Therefore, that's the first lesson learned at that time. Rare does matter, and it's very important what we learn from that. Therefore, that's the first thing. The second thing is, those patients were considered the unlucky ones because they have all this enormous mutation burden. They're getting cancers early, at least in the colon setting. You described it, the Lynch syndrome. They get all those mutations and the consequence of all those cancers. The unlucky ones. Today, when you are diagnosed with diseases, you hope for being mismatch repair deficient because you have therapy. Okay, and that's the same with HER2, and so therefore we see our, over the years with new treatments, actually, also our way of thinking about it on a very personal level changes too, actually. Now, I wonder, right, you know, why when you're in drug discovery, and John, you can comment on that, we do the craziest things. We make drugs for the worst possible scenario to intervene, which is metastatic disease. The most hopeless moment we choose to A, test our drugs and then use them for. That makes, conceptually, it makes zero sense.
Correct.
Now, the big issue is that you don't find a lot of Bills in the world, Brians in the world. That's the first thing. Take, for example, how many cancer centers actually do perform sequencing? Yes, okay, we have now an enormous uptake on Foundation Medicine, which is a third-world company. I mean, they'll hit this, you know, in about the months. They have 250,000 patient sequencing.
Yep.
And by the end of the year, they'll add another 200,000 to that. Therefore, this is going like this. This is very important. But, like, if you look at the cancer centers and the information, how it is actually used, besides the patient themselves coming and saying to the doctor what mutations they have and what potential to be done, is actually really catastrophic. There is almost no impact in even in the big academic centers. Because sometimes they do their sequencing, but then they don't find it. What I mean with that is it doesn't go to the doc who treats. It actually sits, like, they sequence, like, everything, and then it sits in that pathology department to do something with it, but there's no flag, with the exception of maybe two centers that I'm aware of in the U.S. There's no flag back towards, like, the principal, the investigators who actually runs the clinical trial, so that they know that there is a patient in there that this could be used for. It's just not existing. Okay, that's sort of huge problem. The second big problem is that we do not do a good job, also from an economical point of view, we are not rewarding early diagnosis at all. If you found a company that does prevention or diagnosis, you know, this is really tough. Nobody pays for that. Nobody's interested in that. And we have, that's my third and last point, is we have a wrong approach. And that, I think, is, I don't want to blame anybody, but it comes partially also out of the thinking that we have in the academic world, but also in many startups, which is, when it comes to diagnosis, they are all driven by, like, this test must have this incredible sensitivity. If my test doesn't have, like, finds everybody, it's like it's a bad test. Wrong. Totally wrong. It's all about the specificity. And that's towards your point, and we discussed that yesterday at length, you know, about over-diagnosing. What I need to have is, when I diagnose this patient with a new test, I must be certain that this patient has cancer. The sensitivity is not the big deal. I would love to have a test. If we were to be certain that a test works, I would love to have a test that finds early on 30% of patients, because my curing rate will be 100%. This would, if it were to be a drug, one of the best drugs on earth. If I think, you know, there's a lot of things that are unfortunately barriers.
Thank you. Beautifully expressed.
Yeah. John, what about the business perspective, not even necessarily the BD perspective? But
yeah, no, I actually what I was going to do was just add an observation. So to your question, though, I think eventually this will be reality. Right. But I think there's a lag, and I think the ecosystem that would need to adopt this is just not there yet. And sort of what I observe is, Christoph sort of said it, I think it's just the complexity of the landscape right now, and in the community physician trying to implement a lot of these approaches and techniques, it just isn't there. And I think, you know, and I have not spent a lot of time looking into this, the big data approaches and generating data-driven algorithms to help predict sort of treatments. Once you can even develop the diagnostics, I think it's the ecosystem. So let me just take a step back. So I think for this diagnostic to really take off, there needs to be some sort of standardization of it. There needs to be some accreditation of labs that can perform these tests that everybody buys into. We need to have the payers reimbursed for these things, right? So the ecosystem just needs to get there. The science is ahead of that, and I think it will be a reality. It's just these pieces need to fall into place. And again, this is just more from an observation that I'm seeing sort of from arm's length, not being in the oncology arena deep as many others have been here over the past decade and so. But, I mean, just simply put, this is, I think, where we're headed. I think it's not just the driver mutations we need to be looking at. I think you mentioned it, Brian. It's the immune biology for the tumor. It's the tumor microenvironment. I mean, ultimately, if we can standardize and develop these sorts of tests, we can do these things. But I think artificial intelligence, I know it sounds, I mean, it's important, and it's getting a lot of notoriety right now. I just haven't followed it, but I think we need to make it simple for the physicians who are treating these patients. This is I think it's complex for some of the subspecialists. And I think if we can enable the widespread use of this, it will become a reality. So it's an observation I can make.
Yeah. It's and Brian, you will not sort of understand it the wrong way. But if I were to say which are the top three centers, you know, oncology centers that are the closest to a division that we discuss in the U.S., I would say it is MSK, MGH, and Bryan's center in South Dakota. I mean, you know, I mean, just think about that. And that's something wrong. I mean, not there's anything wrong with South Dakota, but like, I'm just thinking about that.
So, Brian, oh, yes, Bob, go ahead. That's I was going to ask similar. So answer Bob's, and then I have a variant question of that, Brian.
So, Bob, it depends upon whom we're working with. So we have. So I mean, if we're working with NCI Match, they're quoting something around a 20% match. We've just done a one-on-one study with Rozelle Kurzrock, which is called the iPredict study. And in that, we've had about a 45-50% match. If you look at our own center, where we combine what is sort of known with what you get from a sequencing report, we're getting up to about 80-85%. So, you know, I was giving a different talk this morning, and someone said, well, you know, my mother doesn't have a particular match on this. So she had ER-positive breast cancer. So if you look at the literature, which most people still do not adopt, we actually give a combination of an aromatase inhibitor, Evero and Palbo or Ribo or Abemo or whatever. We give three drugs in the endocrine. And then we fine-tune depending upon particular alterations which you're seeing in the sequencing. So basically, we're getting up to 70-85% in terms of complete matches with what is known.
So, and you're defining that by currently available drugs, regardless of what their label is.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. As Rozelle says, there is no such thing as off-label. They are genomically targeted therapies in exactly the way the drugs were designed.
So, Brian, if you back out hormone receptor status, though, for breast cancer, for all the other targeted therapy available, what percents do you come up with? Because I think breast cancer is a special situation right now.
So basically, it is 80%. So let me address the one thing that you brought up, and I'll try to combine this together. So at the moment, you have these NCCN guidelines, and Bob, who runs this, and I worked with him, you know, at Stanford, the cancer centers are mandated to stick to NCCN guidelines, which are probably 10 years out of date, and they do not accommodate sequencing at this point in time. So we're seeing people, say, if you take colorectal or pancreatic, you know, they're having FOLFOX, FOLFIRI. So we see them after they've failed two or three lines of therapy. Our breast cancer patients, we never see with RAS/RAF/MEK/ERK because that comes later in the disease. If you treat the tumor extremely early, then the clonal patterns are much simpler. So if you take colorectal, you take pancreatic, KRAS is a driver 80% of the time. So you can just throw trametinib or cobimetinib in there. If you take lung, almost always you've got DNA repair, you need a PD-L1 drug, very often you need a PTEN inhibitor, say, Evro, whatever. If you take HER2 disease, you have four paths of escape. It's basically CDK4/6, DNA repair, immune, and something along the PI3 kinase axis. So all of this is predictable, and you know this, Christoph, just based upon the biology, et cetera. So to come back to your point and to try to combine it with Bob's point, having run a couple of cancer centers, they are bound to stick to NCCN guidelines. They have to accrue at least 14% of their patients on clinical trials. So they go into NCI match, they go into, you know, other things. People turn around and ask why I am at Avera. And Rizal has told me 3-4 times, if I was in Sloan Kettering or at Harvard, I would be fired, simply because they have to stick to convention, routine clinical trials. You cannot innovate in those centers. So I think the one transformative thing which will happen over the next 24 months, Skip Burris is going to become ASCO president. He's at Sarah Cannon. He's run a vast amount of trials. He probably has the largest sample collection with Foundation One. 85% of the patients are treated in the community. They are less restricted. Their doctors are less restricted. So I think there is going to be a huge movement for the community oncologists in order to create this kind of algorithm. So we've already, this is my last sentence because I know somebody else wants to ask a question. We've already basically put obvious biological rules in place. If you have FGF3, 4, 19, which are the ligands, if you have FGFR1 or 2, you give pazopanib or lenvatinib. If you've got a PTEN null, you give Evro. There's now copanlisib in case you need a PI3 kinase alpha inhibitor. Basically, what you need is a patient advocate to get the drugs in every single community center, and we can supply a set of rules at minimal charge in order to basically do the drug matching. So all people have to do is go to Foundation One, Foundation Act, Garden 360, Caris, I don't care what the platform is. There can be a set of rules which guide on the drugs, and you need a patient advocate in order to obtain them.
So let's amplify on that a little bit. And so do you worry about if you have sort of maybe a watch and wait situation? If you give these drugs, you might act. So first of all, side effects may occur. And to a patient who may not have a full-blown cancer. And then the other possibility is you actually select for a worse form of the disease because you're giving the drugs and what you're basically going to promote escape.
Okay, so two things. One is we dose down. So Sloan Kettering up the road has already shown that if you're giving off-target, you need alotinib at 150. If you're giving with an EGFR mutation, you can give 50 milligrams. So we give a quarter of the dose of pazopanib, we give a quarter of the dose of Evro, we put combinations together in which we significantly dose down. When you have patients with 6 drivers, what we do is alternate sequencing. So you cannot give palbo and taxol together. So you give one palbo regimen with 3 compatible drugs, and then you alternate that the next week. I'm sorry, next month with a different triple combination. So you can get the drugs in. our hospitalization rate on 800 patients has been 2.5%. And that's largely come, forgive me, from toxicities from the PD-L1, the PD-1 inhibitors that we did not anticipate at that point. We, you know, had one person who lost a colon. We had not one person with severe neuritis. But our hospitalization rates are absolutely trivial. And as I said, and I did not show enough slides to show this, we try to anticipate the feedback loops. So if you have a colorectal that has a BRAF V600E, we follow Rene Bernard's publication, and we give cetuximab at the same time to block the EGFR escape. What we're doing, forgive me, and I say it very humbly, it is cutting edge. Because every time we do that, we basically break NCCN guidelines. Because NCCN guidelines is, if you are KRAS or BRAF mutated, you should not be giving cetuximab. If you give the two together, you block the driver and the feedback loop. So it trust me, it's feasible. I go into the hospital frightened every morning about, you know, the first patient I'm ever going to have that's going to need hospitalization from our therapy. We haven't had any, basically.
So I have a question. Christoph has a question. We'll let Thomas go.
Thank you. Even if we're able to permeate the community hospitals with these algorithms, how many patients can afford an early and aggressive, comprehensively aggressive approach like that?
So the one blessing that I have living in the Midwest is most of our patients earn less than $80,000 per year. When they earn less than $80,000 per year, we can either persuade the insurance companies or the pharmaceutical companies to basically get us the drugs for free. Now, Foundation One at least, because it's past CMS and FDA, you can get that completely covered. I'm trying to work out packages with Foundation Medicine to get repeat Foundation acts, at least a serial of three, so that we can follow the disease down to a very reasonable point. I think in another 6-9 months, God willing, that problem's going to go away, because I think the Foundation Act is going to be approved by FDA and CMS as well. So basically, we get the drugs free. The only challenges we have are the wealthier patients, where we just cannot get the insurance companies to cover. So we had, you know, one patient who had a great deal of money. He paid for his wife to get olaparib at a neoadjuvant and adjuvant level.
But it doesn't always have to be the extreme, because, I mean, this is heroic what Brian is doing, but I want to give you a simple example that's actually not so extreme. And by the way, the lesson learned from that is how impactful and how important, I think, patient advocacy groups are. Here it is. If you're diagnosed with gastrointestinal stromal tumor, that is driven in 90% of cases by a gene called KIT. We have a drug for that, that's Gleevec. And we know that this had a big impact on that disease. But in 10% of the patient, the mutation sits in a gene called PDGFR. That's the sister gene. And it's very well established amongst the scientists and experts that Gleevec doesn't work at all on that PDGFR. It just doesn't bind that, can't inhibit it. Now, there are drugs out there, and actually I know that because at Blueprint we worked on the drug for those 10% of the GIST patients to make a drug specific for that. That's out there. But here's the big problem. A lot of people don't know about it, and actually most physicians don't know about it. And much better in Europe than it is here, because there is a little bit of central screening. It's standard way. But here the community doc out there just doesn't know about it, because at the time he or her was in med school, there was no KIT description and PDGFR. Therefore, what they do is they give those patients Gleevec irrespective of the mutation. A, they don't screen, and some, the sophisticated ones, test for it, but then give it anyways, even if they know it's not working. Actually, it's a very desperate situation. They give it, and it's not working at all. False hopes, the wrong treatment, missing an opportunity, preventing the cure. That's sort of our situation. And here's the, and I'm not like trying to say, oh, this is all. How does one solve that? How does one educate? How does one get it out to the people? Very often, and that's one of my hopes, is that the patients are actually educated because they Google it and they find out that's what it is, and they go to the doctor and they explain it to the doctor, and the doctor, you know, tries to sort of, I mean, there's a lot of education by the patients who are total non-experts towards the physician. I think that's important. But the other element, and that's my point, is the role of the patient advocacy groups. Like in GIST in particular, very strong advocacy groups in all countries, also in the US, they blast that out. They have all those members, they tell the people, they educate, and almost every patient now, a year after drugs is available, knows that it's important to understand if they have a KIT or a PDGFR mutation, and they are the educators of the medical system.
So if I can just say one thing, I feel stupid because I should have said that before. I mean, what the problem is a patient goes to a doctor. So if you have ovarian cancer, you should go to the Clarity Foundation, who will match you up with, you know, the very best specialist in that field. There are people in GIST, there are people in melanoma, there is a whole met-up group now for metastatic breast. These patient advocate groups have far more lobbying power than any of us. So, you know, we work with about 8 of them. We share our data completely openly. The patient advocacy groups are so powerful. The one last point that I want to raise, just in case no one does, is the FDA now is becoming phenomenal. So the FDA gave a talk of N of 1 at one of our symposia. We had Sean Cozen here, you know, who spoke at our symposium 2 years ago. FDA is becoming incredibly flexible. So I also work with WIN. We're meeting with the FDA on March 21st. They are incredibly receptive to this kind of approach. And, you know, Rich Pazder has just been phenomenal in that job. He's grown and grown. FDA is just really flexible now.
So, John, and so how, to the degree that you can speak on behalf of GSK, how is GSK kind of looking forward in time and envisioning working in a paradigm that is one that, as Brian is describing, you know, he's working in right now. So, and to the degree that that is affecting how you bring along or develop the drugs you have internally, how it affects how you think of what you want to reach out to externally to bring in, because at the end of the day, how you think of a portfolio, not only as an individual company, but as a collective entity that is pharma, you know, those are the drugs that will be the toolkit that Brian, Memorial, MGH, and hopefully a few others will be able to, you know, take up and bring to their patients.
Yeah, no, I think really the only way I can answer that is what we're doing within GSK is really portfolio specific for the time being. But having said that, so we're not looking to do the sorts of things that Brian described today. However, what I can say is in every development, clinical development plan that we have ongoing, we're trying to incorporate a biomarker strategy, obviously, to select patients, to find who the responders will be. And so, I mean, it's a small microcosm of what Brian just described, but it's really dependent on the portfolio we have in front of us and the investments we need to make to bring those medicines that we believe are going to work to the patients. Now, what I can say is, again, it's not as Brian described, but sort of taking the step forward is with the Cancer Moonshot and the Partnership for Accelerating Cancer Immunotherapies, PACT, we're part of the consortium and other pharma parties with PACT to help identify novel biomarkers, validate those biomarkers, and so forth. And so the point I'm trying to make is it's really a multi-pronged approach we'll take within the company. It's asset-specific, and how do we develop a biomarker strategy around those? And we are willing and able to join consortiums or other things to sort of move this forward. And so we're not averse to it. It's just what we're doing right now is really focused on what we have in front of us. But it doesn't mean it's not important.
Okay, so yeah. I have two questions, and then Joel, I know, has a question. So, Brian, start with you. So, you have a living, breathing system now that is generating a huge amount of data to the degree that machine learning, et cetera, can begin to map. So, yes, you're hitting hard, you're hitting early, you're attempting to preempt some of those downstream pathways that might be activated in response to that Darwinian selective pressure. How are you collecting, generating, studying, and publishing, and have you yet published, on what you're learning about, you know, what happens when you hit hard and hit early? Now, granted, you know, you have very high overall kind of responses, but, you know, it's distributed between CRs and PRs and stable disease, et cetera. So what are you learning right now that ultimately will become actionable in the next few years or 5 years or beyond to you and to others about the perturbed ecosystem that is cancer in a patient?
Okay, Jeff, so excellent question, 3-4 levels. So we're putting out our first 4 publications this year. The first one, God willing, will be with Rizal in Nature Medicine within the next 2 months. Number two, the rules that we have generated are basically, you know, Christoph could write these rules. I mean, it's fairly obvious matches where you've got an FGF alteration, you do this. Where you have an EGFR alteration, you do this. The most critical thing in which we have done is basically the dosing algorithms, because we've now come up with like a stable of about 15, 20 combinations that we can give, you know, completely separately. And we're now building an app so that that goes out into the community. As we build this community network and we're getting into 10,000 patients, I think machine learning at that point will really become invaluable, providing you've got great recessed reads, reliable recessed reads, and you know, true and excellent database. But I am working with the patient advocacy groups. I'm working with NFCR. I'm working with not-for-profits. We need two things. You need a patient advocate in every single center who will help you get the drugs. And we have people who can train them do this. And the second most important thing is the database, which people can, you know, openly learn from.
So you are continuing to sequence over time so that any new changes, whether those are in known genes or to-be-discovered genes or pathways, become visible to you as these people are monitored and treated in real
Correct.
Time?
Correct. So I took one set of slides out of there. I'm sorry I missed the Grail one. But I took one set of slides. So we had a 37-year-old, I think I presented this last year, with stage 4 breast cancer. And she had 4 alterations. So we treated 3 of them. She went into complete response. We saw a resistance mechanism come up. And we took one drug out, put another one in. And then we had a residual thing in the ctDNA, and so we changed the drug again. She has been in complete response now for 3 years, had her therapy flexed twice, and she's been in complete response all the time. And I think that is going to be the path of the future. And in all fairness, forgive me, I've not talked this through with GSK, but I talked this through with Novartis and Roche and Genentech, and they think that this is the way to go.
So one quick question, then, and I know Christoph wants to comment, and Joel.
And I don't want to dominate.
Yeah, no, but it begs the question. This applies to everyone. So, in the much of what you've described are based on targeted mutations. Although you've alluded to immunotherapy, is there a situation where you say now I've got this patient into remission, you know, initially or ultimately through these various lines and changes of mostly the targeted agents? Is there a role for a low-dose checkpoint or whatever to come in to try and, you know, maintain or soup up and maintain the immune system's response? Or are you presuming that that is by nature getting kicked in and brought to bear once you've more or less tamped down the cancer itself with these combinations of mostly small molecule targeted approaches?
So that's pretty hard to answer. The chap that I actually showed you, we treated with a triple combination. He got tired of his platinum, so we took him off that. So he's still on the immune therapy and the cabo. We've taken the cabo dose down now. His ctDNAs are persistently negative. This is the whole dilemma we face for so many years on HER2-positive breast cancer. When do you stop? So now with the ctDNAs, we're actually using this as a decision point to stop therapy.
Okay, because that's one of the notes I wrote to myself was when to start, what to start, when to stop, when to change.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right, Joel, sorry. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, so very interesting conversation. It strikes me listening to Brian, and this isn't necessarily a question for Brian, that there's a disconnect between what the market demands in the sense of what the physician would like to have and what the market is providing. So my guess is that Brian would like to have more targeted therapies that can be used for patients that score positive on other markers on the Foundation One test that he just doesn't currently have in his quiver. And the reason, or a reason, that there are five marketed PD-1 or L1s on the market today is because there is good incentive to do so within the current development paradigm, right? They're clinically de-risked, and there's sufficient commercial opportunity for these companies to take a de-risked modality, bring it through the regulatory path, and then carve out their own unique label. So I guess my point is that with the current development paradigm, having to go through phase two and then a scaled up phase three, demonstrating significant benefit against an active control or a placebo control, which results in so much attrition, and the pharma industry uses to justify high price points for the drugs that do make it to the goal line. Wouldn't it make sense from a regulatory standpoint and from just an economic standpoint to lower the bar for what it takes to get novel targeted therapies onto the market? They need to demonstrate safety. They need to demonstrate target engagement. They need to show that they're doing what they say they're doing in patients through pharmacodynamics. But to not go much further than that, and then instead of having five PD-1s, which Brian, you know, can't use, having five different targeted therapies, which may not check off all the boxes that regulators require, but at least provide him with different tools in his chest that he can throw at patients that he currently doesn't have.
I think, does somebody else want to go?
Yeah, maybe I start. And I think this is a super question. It's so difficult to answer because there's so many different elements in it. The first one is, I think flat iron collected all those electronic data, and they were just looking at colon cancer and looked at different treatments and in the detail, like
doses and like duration and how in the combination. And why did they do this? Because they expected colon cancer, that's very clearly established standard of care. I mean, for years. And what they found was very surprising. They found when they looked into the details, more than 100, I think it was like 180 or whatever, 100, more than 100 different ways of giving that standard of care. Okay? Now, here's the surprising piece to it. They only looked at 4 hospitals. Okay? Therefore, this is the first problem to come to an answer, which is when we are regulating, and it's not a criticism, it's just a dilemma. When we are regulating, we are first doing it by line of treatment, which is so weird, right? There's a third line. You approved in fourth line. What does that really mean? And the second thing is we have an enormous, which is a good thing on the other hand, individualization of how we give it, because that patient doesn't tolerate it, we dose it down, we do this, whatever. But the way we approve the drug ignores all of that, okay? Because we are placing ourselves in lines of treatment, not towards the genotype of the patient or the individuality of that. And this makes your question so complicated, okay? There is no good answer, and because the label is very important. It's a real dilemma.
So I will make 4 points. And the first one is the most important. If only we could transmit out to 85% of the community oncologists exactly what we're doing now. If only we had patient advocates out there, built a database, prescribed aggressively early, we would completely transform cancer now. So in terms of the drugs, I mean, Bert Vogelstein said this like 4 years ago at AACR, that something like 90% of the stuff had been discovered. It was just up to people to apply it. So yes, I would like something against CCNE1. I need a CDK2 inhibitor. I'd like something against MYC. I'd like something against RAS. I'd like something which tackle macrophages. I'd like some T-cell agonists. I'd like something for the tumor microenvironment. How hugely significant this is going to be, I don't know. We've got a pretty good cocktail just right at this moment in time. We probably need a T-cell agonist or whatever, but, you know, we're not pretty good if we hit early on when the immune system is competent. So the third thing, and this is going back to your point, Christoph, about patient advocates, there's a whole group of people now who are pushing the FDA to approve drugs at the end of phase one. So, you know, the conference I was at this morning, you know, the Loxo drug, things like the ALK inhibitors, a lot of these drugs are getting approved on single agent, non-randomized trial. I think it was 2 years ago, Jeff watched me have this debate here about whether we needed a randomized trial or whether it was going to be single arm, and a lot of this stuff now could be done single arm. I mean, I've got one patient advocate out there in his 80s who lost his wife and his daughter to cancer simply because he didn't have the access to drugs. And he's now just fighting like hell to get drugs approved at a much earlier stage and then do a more extensive monitoring program when you've got the drug there. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism lately from the Goldwater Foundation and the fact that they did this right, got this right to try approved now in something like 40 states, I totally applaud it. And I think that if we could do this with cancer, then I think it would be a huge change. But to go back to Christoph's comment, and this is my last comment, if you read The Death of Cancer by Vince DeVita, he points out this whole difficulty of basically matching drugs against a condition, against an alteration in a particular disease. And he says this is science going backwards. A drug is designed for a specific alteration. It should be approved for that alteration, whatever it is. And if I had one piece of advice for GSK, you know, and advice is worth how much you pay for it, which is nothing, I would say follow the Pembro model, which they did with MSI. I've just told Exelixis, you know, to just take all of their VEGF, P53, RET alterations, do a global trial, any tumor type, and then get the drugs approved according to the alteration. Let's start moving away from these large tissue-based trials, and let's move to, I mean, Rich approved that, Rich Pazda approved that as a model of the way to go. Take the alterations, forget the tumor, just get the drug approved for the biomarker.
And it's going that way, right? I mean, take Loxo, with N-drug, take Blueprint with the PDGFR, take Agios with IDH. Those basket trials are all going, they all got approval, and those approval will be across indications. I think there's enormous progress over the last year and a half or so. I mean, that's really a spectacular. This is incredible. We always are so negative, but that's super incredible. This is changing. Now it's 1% of all cancers, which, you know, you get, which is much bigger than if it were to be 20% of a cancer type. Therefore, I think this is the big future. We saw some example that Lee mentioned earlier today, also the same way. All those indications like Langerhans now, where actually, you know, the where we have the BRAF inhibitors working. I mean, those are all coming out of basket trials. They have impact on diseases that many people don't know exist, and I think that's the future. It's yeah. Super that this is happening.
So if I'm going to make one last comment, then I would say...
You only get 20, right?
Then I would very simply say, as I mentioned yesterday, every time you give an IGF-1R inhibitor, you upregulate phosphomec phospho work. If you're giving BRAF, V600E, venurafenib, whatever, in colorectal, you automatically upregulate EGFR. So some drugs can only be approved if you're doing them in combination. And we are progressively moving towards an N of one world. And I think what you need to do, John, and all the companies need to do with FDA is work out a model in an N of one world how you get drugs approved on the fewest possible patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we have two choices. Either it works a little bit, and we need thousands of patients to prove this. Me personally, I'm not interested in that. Or we need a very small number, but the effect is so big that everybody goes like, this is a drug. And that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, right.
Okay? And it's not that complicated. And then how it's applied from there on, that's like what we just have been discussing. But it must be, I mean, if a drug has less than a 50% response rate, I think it's shit. Okay? That's just my own opinion, and I wouldn't be proud of making such a drug. Okay? But I didn't say how big that population has to be. If this is 1% of, like, you know, whatever something breast cancer, great. Okay? But give me the response, okay? That's, I think, what matters.
So This is great, and this is echoing themes that Laura brought up, and I think someone in one of the morning panels mentioned about, you know, these shorter, faster trials looking for just the PK/PD, et cetera, to get them out. But so let me be devil's advocate here, and this sort of resonates off Joel's question. Does it then make us too reductionist if we are just looking at only these specific changes, or even if we're looking for a major activity signal as a monotherapy in those settings, given that there's a whole context that may be influencing why that drug may not have a great response as a single agent on its own, but might in fact be quite interesting when you combine it with all sorts of other things, which of course as a small biotech, they've got a novel target, they may not have the wherewithal to do that. So does that mean that we just by definition are selecting for only those targets relevant with the big level of activity? And if we do that, is that what we should be doing, or would we be missing out on something?
So can I, sorry, I just want to make a, I sort of had a similar point, and I wanted to base it off of the question that you asked. I thought it was a really interesting question, but the way I interpreted it was whether or not you were asking whether or not we should divert resources, let me say, allocate resources more towards the targeted therapies, lower the bar to get those out there and employ some of these sequencing approaches and so forth. That's the way I interpreted it. And I guess what I would say is sort of then to follow on, Jeff, to what you just said is I think what we need to do is get smart about finding those transformational effects by being having the biomarker identified, the patient, the likely responders identified, get that response, but it's multiple different biological approaches that we do need to go after. I think there is obviously a place for targeted therapies, but I do believe that we need to combine sort of what Brian is doing here more broadly across yep. different biological pathways, and but be really smart about how we set up the studies so that we get those transformational effects, because I agree 100%. It needs to be 50%. You need to knock our socks off. I feel like the industry as a whole might be a bit redundant and capital inefficient by going after 20 PD-1s. I think we have enough there for now. But there are other biologies that we can begin to exploit, but in a very smart way where we can lower the bar from a regulator perspective by designing the right studies with the right way to predict responders.
But it also begs then for more early collaboration between entities, yeah. right? Because all these drugs that Brian's using were all developed individually, right. not optimized. Now, you're trying to get at that by lowering doses, but if people were sharing data, doing those experiments between companies early on, then you might be seeing, you know, a lot of interesting things and also have a better chance that those are going to play well with others, right? I mean, that's part of the problem, and Axel has published about this with many of the MTKIs that may have interesting immunomodulatory activity. Sometimes those also have some detrimental activity on T cells or other things because they weren't developed or selected to avoid that.
But we also need to stay honest. And there's a lot going on between, you know, companies. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody shared anything with anybody. Combination was like a 3-year negotiation in order to get it into. It's no longer the case right now. It's like pretty boilerplate. We'll exchange. We do things together. We share profit, like whatever. I mean, there's a lot going on. But we need to be honest, too. We cannot, I think, lowering the bar, bad idea. It's my opinion. Because let's be very honest. Most of the drugs that we discover and develop do not work. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we need, this is the majority. This is actually more than 90% of our drugs that we are making, okay, and that we are testing are not working. And we cannot cheat our way through this by lowering a bar. Because you look for a long time for an indication for a drug that is not working.
Yeah. Well, that okay? was going
to
be my...
Just to be very, very clear.
That was going to be my next point, because...
Be inventive, figure it out, find your small proof of concept, do this fast, but better have a drug that works and knocks people's socks off. That's still, we cannot lower the bar.
Yeah, and I was going to kind of flip then my point to address many biotechs that we've seen where one might, and this isn't only biotechs, so I don't want to pick on them, pharma does it too, where the bar is so low that you can really look back and say, well, why on earth did they take that into a phase 3, let alone even to a phase 2 based on either early signals in a phase 1b or even the preclinical data. It's like, all right, just because once you started, there's a momentum and inertia that kind of keeps you going. And there's all sorts of human reasons for that, but I think you're right. At the end of the day, a much greater scrutiny. I mean, we all have heard the mantra of, you know, kind of not only
you know, kill or make the early no-go or the early kill decision rather than kind of having something limp along that should have died long ago, because those resources could be going to the drug that has the 50% or 80% effect size. All right, we're down to the last minute or so. Well, three by my clock, so 48 seconds. All right, anyone have any questions out there, any other comments that we've had? Because otherwise, I am going to talk really slowly until that clock goes to zero. Mike.
Yes?
I'm going to pick on you.
Okay.
Ask a good question to end us off here. Come on. Earn your pay. I don't know who's paying you, but earn it.
So, Jeff, let me just summarize.
Please.
All right. Number one, as John said, we need to get smart. Let's stop tumor-based trials and move towards biomarker-based trials, whatever they are. Number two, when you've got things like Aloxo, trastuzumab, whatever, let's run trials the way they're running them. And try and get the drugs approved after a long phase one, a phase two, with nothing randomized. Number three, this is going to be the most difficult. It's when you need doublets. So, for instance, when you've got an IGF-1R and phospho-ERK, you're going to have to get drugs approved, not with big randomized trials, but you're going to have to get doublets approved in specific settings. Number four, the most important point is the neoadjuvant. Test the drugs much earlier. But the last, and to me, most important point is if we took the knowledge of what we have now, what we're doing, and we could get this applied to 85% of community oncology, we'd be saving hundreds of thousands of lives.
Thank you for that. Last words.
And
be, almost last.
And for all the drug discoverers, be innovative. Me toos are so boring.
Mm-hmm. All right. Agreed. John, last comment?
Agreed.
All right, there you go. That's a very positive note. It is cancer progress, so agreed. I rule in favor. All right, motion passed. Thank you for attending the conference. Thank you.